The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anika Gal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour Magazine. And it's all online, you know. They don't make the hard copies anymore. But I've printed out some fabulous, I don't know, you can determine if it's fabulous or not, but there's some pretty good articles here. And we know that, goodness, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry just had their first baby, and we're going to be talking about that just a little bit, see how life in the royal phase of things goes with a new baby. We just got a bunch of details about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's new life as parents. Much to the delight of royal fans, Meghan Markle put her maternity leave on pause over the weekend to make an appearance at Trooping the Colour, wearing her wedding dress designer Givenchy and sporting a new ring that was a gift from her husband, Prince Harry. It was the first time we've seen the Duchess of Sussex since she and Prince Harry introduced their son, Archie Harrison, to the world. This is similar to the Duchess of Cambridge's maternity leave, where she made a few appearances at family and personal events, Trooping the Colour and Wimbledon, but did not carry out any official duties as a member of the royal family during maternity leave, a source told Elle. Sources also tell Elle that Markle and Prince Harry are happily settling into parenthood. Archie is the cutest little thing I've ever seen. They couldn't be happier, one insider said. The report also mentions that the Duchess of Sussex is breastfeeding and that Prince Harry is very involved with everything, including diaper changes. He's, quote, enjoying every minute of it, end quote, according to a source, and Meghan is radiant, taking each day one day at a time. What strikes me most is the authentic peacefulness that has settled within her. Prince Harry's good friend, Nacho Figueres, says, per Elle, I met the baby in London before playing polo with Prince Harry in Rome, and he was very good with the baby. He's a natural. He knows what to do. He's already an amazing father. According to U.S. Weekly, Markle's life right now is focused on Archie. We all expected her to be thinking about work, but her life revolves around Archie at the moment, a source tells the magazine. The insider continues that while spending so much time at Frogmore Cottage can be a little overwhelming at times, Markle is approaching motherhood one day at a time and loving every moment. Archie, according to U.S. Weekly's sources, is adorable and super chubby, very quiet, and very well-behaved. Doria Ragland said that Meghan was the same when she was a baby. Apparently, Markle had a difficult time saying goodbye to Archie to attend Trooping the Colour. But Meghan truly wanted to be at the celebration for the Queen, the U.S. insider said. She loved seeing all the other royal children and was doting on them. Additional sources tell Elle that the Sussexes are enjoying their new home in Windsor and that it is providing the family with so much happiness. It is quiet and out of the hustle and bustle of London, for them all to be able to walk freely and enjoy the beautiful area in such a sensational treat. Reportedly, Archie has had quite a few visitors, including Kate Middleton and Prince William, Serena Williams and her husband, Alexis Ohanian, and Markle's best friend, Jessica Mulroney, along with her daughter, Ivy, who was a bridesmaid at Markle and Prince Harry's wedding last year. As for Markle, a source says she may make intermittent appearances while her maternity leave continues, and we may even get our second Archie sighting during his christening in a few weeks. We can't wait. Well, that story is kind of in the just the opposite vein from the next one from Glamour. This one's entitled, I'm Afraid to Tell My Male Bosses I'm Pregnant. Women with children are considered less competent than those without. The longer I can pretend I'm one of the women without, the better. Would you like to know the gender? The woman had announced the results of a first trimester blood test, asked over the phone. She had just told me my near geriatric pregnancy looked fine so far. Gripping onto the steering wheel of my car on my way back from an interview for a news story, I fiddled with the air conditioning, waiting for this stranger, whose name I don't know, to give me news about my 13-week fetus. Congrats, she said, clearly bored after relaying the news yet again to someone that day, so I guess the congrats was more like, congrats. Then she hung up. We're having a girl. I'm terrified. I'm 34, freelance, i.e. unemployed, and facing an uphill battle as I think about how I'll claw my way back into the workforce full-time once I deliver. But in that moment, I was so excited that I pulled over to call my husband. I'm 6 months pregnant now, and now my editors know. Most of them are male. Many of them have kids. I know because they talk about them all the time in the doting, loving way only a father can. One mentions his children while working from home when I submit a 6,000-word feature. It's a tough handoff day between him and his wife. Another apologizes when he's delayed in responding to my edits because he has been taking care of 2 sick children since his return from an international vacation. Each time I speak to one of them on the phone, I hang up in awe with the ease they speak about being fathers. I am so envious. I haven't told anyone that I'm pregnant. When I go on assignment with a colleague, I wear a massive button-down, lifting the camera gear with my knees and hoping I can hide the burgeoning bump. The only other professional colleague I've told is another female freelance journalist. Over chicken wings in rural Appalachia, she told me she has worked with other female freelance journalists who've decided to wait to have children until after the 2020 election or until they are hired full-time somewhere. That night, after another 14-hour reporting day, I think about what she said. It terrifies me, but it also makes me feel more sane. I know I have to withhold this information. The more I reveal, the greater the risk to my career. And about my career, here's what it's like. I spent the majority of 6 months after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico investigating claims that the Puerto Rican government made in the aftermath of the crisis. When I asked for a single day off to see my Irish husband become an Irish-American citizen, my then-boss waited until the day before to ask if I really had to go. I assured him, no, not at all, it was fine. When protests broke out in Charlotte, North Carolina, after a white police officer shot and killed an African-American resident, I drove with a cameraman overnight to sleep in a pay-by-the-hour motel to be the first team there to cover the riots. When I worked in Afghanistan, I spent 2 years traveling alone across the country for work and research, dodging questions about whether I was qualified to run a team of Afghan men. Each time I had family or friends visit during a quiet period, I've been called away without fail. Once my parents came to town, and for the first time in nearly a decade, I lived in the United States. Mom had plans to make samosas the next day and take us to Costco so I could stock up on books and food samples. Of course, at 3 a.m., my phone rang, asking me to go cover a protest somewhere. I jumped out of bed and made it onto a 5 a.m. flight. I love what I do, and this is the reality it demands. So for the most part, I've hidden every small pleasure of the last 6 months. From the first time she kicked me so hard on a flight back from a reporting trip that I jumped out of my window seat and reached for the exit row lever, causing the air hostess to panic, to the first time we heard her heartbeat and the anatomy scan where she wiggled around, sucking her thumb. Studies have shown when someone is described in the workplace as a mother, evaluators rate her as, quote, less competent than when she is described as not having children, end quote. I've watched, mouth agape, what happens when women come back from maternity leave. Their phones ring, and less experienced, more junior men pick up with a dramatic eye roll. She's walked away again, they'd huff. In fact, she was in a closet on the 7th floor, pumping. The stigma against mothers at work reveals itself under even more innocuous circumstances. After the White House correspondents' dinner, a CNBC White House reporter tweeted that a male editor from a well-known outlet had asked her if she knew one of his reporters from a mom group. No, she responded. I know her from my job. Worse still, it's not just men who have this bias. A colleague once told me she had never seen a successful female TV field producer be both a wife and a mother. Because you're already married, I guess that's that, she said. Years before I got pregnant, I was made well aware of the risks my gender and desire for a family posed. Even when women don't have children, they don't receive the same raises and equal footing as their male counterparts in their late 20s, making it difficult to catch up later, a study from the Royal Bank of Canada shows. I once had a boss who managed me from a cushy coastal area tell me, while he visited me in the field, that it was better my husband hadn't moved with me so I would at least focus on my job. That male boss had a wife and kids whom he lived with and saw nearly every single day while running an entire bureau. Another time, a woman pulled me aside and asked me how strong my marriage was because I was at risk of divorce as an ambitious woman. A few months later, I asked my husband if he had ever gotten a similar sit-down talk. Never, he said. I've had to accept that my husband has luxuries I do not. When I sent him a picture at some point in my second trimester, after I had suddenly popped and my new belly was out in full force, he asked if I was going to post it on social media. Yeah, right, I texted back. He asked if he could post it. After a brief hesitation, I agreed he could put it on Facebook because his settings are so extreme, I'm not even sure I can see some of his posts. A few days later, when we were on a rainy Saturday night cravings run, he took a surreptitious picture of me ordering a bean and cheese burrito and instantly posted it online. His bosses knew I was pregnant before my in-laws did. For men, as the New York Times puts it simply, having a child is good for their careers. They are more likely to be hired than childless men and tend to be paid more after they have children. More than once, I've woken up my husband at 5 a.m., asking him what kind of world we're bringing our daughter into. I worry that the world will be no better to women than it is now, once she grows up. I jolt awake in a cold sweat, thinking about how to handle her getting bullied on social media, wondering how she'll navigate being Indian Irish American, and whether we'll be able to take her to Ireland for Christmas and San Diego for Diwali each year. I wonder where the hashtag MeToo movement will be. I think about what kind of name we should give her so she doesn't get a huh each time she says it over the phone, like I do. I wonder most of all about what it'll be like for her one day when she's navigating her place in the universe. I wonder about what will happen if she decides to have children, whether she'll be able to revel in what should be one of the happiest periods of her life, or whether she'll be like me, keeping it a secret to snatch back a few more months of people thinking she is a competent, capable woman. Then I think, screw that. At my last doctor appointment, I negotiated an extension to the date I can last take an assignment that means a plane ride or a long drive. Begrudgingly and with a grin, my doctor pushed the, quote, stop travel date, end quote, to 35 weeks. To my editors, by the way, I'm pregnant. Khushbu Shah is a freelance journalist based in Atlanta. Previously, she worked across Latin America, Europe, and Afghanistan. All right, in our next one, women, sports, and the power of a uniform. World Cup. When the U.S. women's national team takes the soccer field in France, they will be wearing uniforms that make a statement and show just how far women's sports have come. This is by Wendy Noggle. Before a workout, we pull on our leggings and wiggle or shove ourselves into a sports bra. We put on a high-performance tee, lace up our sneakers, and then forget about it all. That's the point. You should be able to focus on your workout, not your gear. Except when you can't. A bra chafes, a shirt rides up, pants sag. When your workout wear doesn't fit right, it's the only thing you can think about. If you're trying to compete at an elite level, like the U.S. women's national team, that distraction is the last thing you need. Their gear has to be Goldilocks good, not too big, not too small, but just right for 90-plus minutes on the pitch. Thankfully, when the USWNT takes the field in the World Cup this month, they will have some of the most technologically advanced uniforms ever made for women's soccer, with fabrics that speed drying time and a fit based on 3 years of body scans and athlete feedback. The number one thing is comfort, says Cassie Looker, senior appeal product manager of global football for Nike. We have data about what an elite footballer looks like. We know how much power they generate from their lower body, glutes, thighs, and hamstrings, and we really design for the body in motion. Short length, for example, is a key factor. You don't want it too short because that's too revealing, but too long can really prohibit all that dynamic movement, says Looker. So is the neckline, opening, sleeve fit, and the length of the jersey itself, so it doesn't ride up. Megan Rapinoe, in a friendly match against Canada, is featured. Three stars on the shorts and neck, honor of the USWNT team, wins at the 91, 99, and 15 World Cups. To let them know, we have three, and we're coming for four. Mal Pug, or Pew, Rapinoe's teammate and a forward for the team, said when she saw the kit for the first time. As women have been breaking barriers in sports, they've often had to do it in poor conditions, on injury-provoking fields, or with ill-fitting or outright sexist gear, all while getting paid far less than their male counterparts. A lot of work still needs to be done to close the gap on equal pay for female athletes, but sportswear, at least, has improved dramatically. Athletes have also used their uniforms to make a statement about fashion, sure, but also about power and equality. Fencer Ibtihaj Muhammad made history when she became the first U.S. Olympian to wear a hijab in competition. She knew how influential that image would be to girls around the world. Some messages are more subtle, like the three stars on the shorts and neck of the USWNT World Cup jerseys, which honor the team's 91, 99, and 15 World Cup wins. "Let him know we have three and we're coming for four," Malpieu, a forward for the team, sees it as a statement to their opponents. Three stars on the team jerseys signify the USWNT's three World Cup wins. So just how far have we come? Well, you can be thankful you don't have to do your next workout in a maxi skirt. Golf, Mildred Didrikson earned the nickname Babe after Babe Ruth when she was growing up because she scored so many home runs in neighborhood baseball games. She was a gold medalist in javelin and hurdles at the 1932 Olympics. But the all-around athlete is best known for her career in golf. In 1938, she became the first woman to compete against men in the Los Angeles Open. No other woman would compete against men in this tournament for 60 years. She often played in a straight skirt that hit her mid-calves and sometimes sewed the clothes herself. A far cry from Michelle Wie's signature spandex skorts. And softball. In 1943, the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League took the field in above-the-knee flare dresses and knee socks. Even their hats were one-size-fits-all. Thankfully, in the modern era, the USA Softball Women's National Team has had more appropriate attire to round the bases. They also have one of the most winning team records in all of sports and plan to build on that legacy when softball returns in the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. And what other sport? Track and field. As a child, Olympic runner Wilma Rudolph contracted polio and scarlet fever. "My doctor told me I would never walk again. My mother told me I would." I believed my mother. She once said, this is what she once said, at the 1960 Olympics in Rome, wearing high-rise shorts with an elasticized waist, she took home three gold medals. Flash forward more than 20 years, and American sprinter Florence Griffith Joyner turned heads with her one-legged jumpsuits, one pink and one green, and a two-legged jumpsuit made from sheer white stretch lace at the 1988 Olympic trials. Joyner designed some of her own uniforms and had a mantra that served her well. "Dress good to look good to feel good, and feel good to run fast." Run fast she did. Her records in the 100-meter and 200-meter remain unbroken. Distance running. When Bobby Gribb became the first woman to run the Boston Marathon in 1966, she jumped into the race wearing a hoodie and her brother's Bermuda shorts in order to blend in with the field. Catherine Switzer was the first woman with an official bib number. She signed up as K.V. Switzer. There was no box for gender to check. and wore baggy gray sweats at the start of the race. She'd planned to wear a just-ironed burgundy top and matching shorts, but the weather was too cold, and she had to pile on a layer. She ditched her sweats partway through the course, but nothing could be done with her shoes. When a podiatrist examined her feet after the finish, they were so blistered he nearly fainted. She couldn't get her shoes back on and hobbled off in her socks. It wasn't until 1984 that the women's marathon became an Olympic event, and Joan Benoit won a decisive victory in a basic singlet and a custom pair of Nike shoes. The only blistering was her time. 2 hours, 24 minutes, 52 seconds, which is still the American Olympic record. At 61, she won her age division at the 2019 Boston Marathon. And fencing. In 2016, Ibtihaj Muhammad was the first U.S. Olympian to compete in a hijab. She took up saber fencing because it allowed her to play sports and respect her faith without any uniform modifications. She told the New York Times that she faced resistance from her coach and fellow teammates, but she was proud to show young girls that Muslim women could compete on the world stage. To do that is changing the way Muslim women think about themselves and perceive themselves. Her hijab was included when Mattel made a Barbie of Muhammad in tribute to the Olympian's accomplishments. And tennis. Billie Jean King knew she'd need to stand out against the flashy Bobby Riggs in their Battle of the Sexes matches in 1973. She asked legendary British tennis courtier Ted Tinling to design her dress. His creation was a shimmering silk-lined outfit, according to Smithsonian.com. But once King put it on, she said she could never wear it for competition. It was too scratchy. Tinling had a backup option, a wide-collar blue nylon dress, and the morning of the match sewed on rhinestones so she'd stand out in the lights. The dress felt perfect and is now in the Smithsonian National Museum. Similarly, Serena Williams had a custom-made black cat suit for the 2018 French Open. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Make it a great week. See you next time.